May it please the court.
You may proceed.
This is a capital post-conviction appeal, and the state is seeking to execute my client, Christopher Collings, for a conviction that was based on two legal fictions that went unchallenged by his trial counsel. The first is that he acted and deliberated as a generically sober person. And second, that his brain was able at the time to form accurate memories upon which his police statement and thus inferences of his deliberation were based. Christopher's trial counsel failed to introduce significant evidence of his lifelong addiction to alcohol and drugs and his severe intoxication on the night of the crime to rebut the state's evidence of deliberation or to challenge the inference of deliberation that the state drew from his confessions. Counsel also failed to investigate and introduce this same evidence in penalty phase to establish the statutory mitigator that Christopher's capacity to appreciate the criminality of his conduct or conform his conduct to the requirements of the law was substantially impaired. And I'm asking this court to prevent Christopher's execution and reverse his conviction that was based on these fictions and failings of counsel, and to grant him a new trial for three important reasons that are unique to this case. The first is that it's a death case. That there's a heightened degree of reliability that's required under all kinds of U.S. Supreme Court cases, from Lockett to Eddings, Enman, and Tyson, which require a heightened degree of reliability before we can extinguish a life. And this verdict is not reliable because the jury was prevented from determining his actual subjective mental state or fully evaluating his brain's ability to form memories upon which his confessions were based. And I realize that this is a very difficult case with extremely upsetting facts, not the least of which is that there are four confessions made. Very repetitive, all the same, but they were relied heavily upon by this jury in the direct appeal as evidence of his deliberation. And evidence that the jury didn't hear is that Christopher's brain, after 30 beers, was not capable of forming those types of memories that would form the basis of that confession.
I thought the medical evidence showed no defects in his brain. There were no structural abnormalities that appeared in the MRIs.
The MRI showed no abnormalities, but that's explained because the brain quickly repairs itself. And by the time
so what was the evidence that he had some structural problem as a result of the use of drugs and alcohol?
Well, I don't know that we're required to show that there was any significant structural defect, because Dr. Piasecki testified that the significant alcohol intoxication that he was under, if that evidence is to be believed, and the state really didn't dispute that the defense introduced evidence that he was at least 30 beers drunk at the time, and Nathan McHeron corroborated that, that type of significant alcohol intoxication would have resulted in aggressive impairments in his brain functioning, including decreased inhibition, impaired comprehension, the inability to take information and process, understand and apply it, and stop and consider his actions. And importantly, as it relates to his confessions, his later confessions, is that the part of his brain that's responsible for capturing and encoding memories are sensitive to the toxic effects of alcohol and will go offline during periods of high alcohol intoxication. People lose their ability to record memories and have blackouts. They're still conscious, but their memory is not working. And we're assuming that his confessions are based on memories at the time. And clearly from Dr. Piasecki's testimony, his memories could not have been recorded at that level of intoxication. And that was important for the jury to hear when they were evaluating his confession, because that's another unique fact about this case, is that it is his confessions are the only evidence against him. If he had not confessed first, David Spears' confession, the state would have run with it. And the only reason they didn't convict or prosecute David Spears for this capital case is because Christopher confessed first, and this prosecutor would have had, and he admitted, would have had to prosecute inconsistent theories because their confessions are different, factually different. And this is important because Christopher's death sentence is based solely on his confessions that is inconsistent with the physical evidence that we know and is also inconsistent with the co-defendant's confession. So it's highly unreliable to begin with, yet the jury wasn't able to understand why that was. Because of his high degree of intoxication, he could not have formed those memories. And we know that anyone who's lived with an alcoholic, raised by an alcoholic, knows that blackouts are real, that memories, people don't remember things that happened when they were that drunk.
You say it was inconsistent with the confession of the co-defendant and inconsistent with the physical facts. I think you also argue in a point that it was inconsistent with the testimony of other witnesses as to events that occurred at the home that night.
Correct.
Unrelated witnesses.
Correct, and that was all, several of the points are related to other factual things that occurred that counsel didn't investigate that would have shown that Christopher's confession just cannot be accurate. And all of these things are things that the jury should have heard, but it is the alcohol evidence and Dr. Piasecki's expert testimony that would have made them understand why his confession should not be relied upon. And had the jury had some reasonable doubt about that confession, they could not have convicted him at least of first-degree murder because of his inability to deliberate. And in the jury's eyes, both as to guilt and...
Well, that's a very different thing. You said it shows his confession was unreliable, but then you said it's relevant to his inability to deliberate, which is what the cases say you can't use it for. Those are two different, very different
points. Right. Well, under cases like State versus David Taylor, State versus Heflinger, I believe counsel could have introduced evidence of intoxication to show why his confession was not credible.
And did counsel attempt to do that?
No, they failed to do that because they believed that that evidence goes to his mental state and would not be allowed by the trial court. Clearly, they should have introduced it to challenge the credibility of his confession, the reliability of his confession, because it was the only evidence
Did you raise that below in that way, that it was relevant to the confession?
The claim that's raised contemplates that we were not able to rebut inferences of guilt that were drawn by the state from his confessions and all the other evidence. And so it does contemplate that claim. The bottom line was that counsel testified that they didn't made no strategy decision not to challenge the statute or instruction with expert testimony, and they just didn't consider it. And I think at the hearing, Attorney Zimbels testified that she thought the jury would be turned off by alcohol evidence, and yet she proceeded to talk about the alcohol evidence in her opening statement and elicit that information from the co-defendant Mahurin. And so that's really not reasonable. If the jury was going to be turned off by that, she wouldn't have relied upon it. And so there was really no reasonable strategic reason not to go after the alcohol evidence and present it to the jury to explain his confession, which was the only evidence against him. And it was really important because in the jury's eyes, the fact that someone who killed was motivated by a self-destructive tendency, such as an addiction or severe intoxication, which clearly existed for Christopher, it might make the crime seem more generically tragic and less demanding of retribution. It might make him seem less clearly evil and more capable of rehabilitation. And Christopher is not an evil person, as evidenced by the fact in our brief that he has saved another human life, which was also not investigated by counsel. They didn't put on evidence that he saw someone trying to commit suicide and held him up, held the ropes, and made it slack so that he wouldn't die. He saved a human life. He regularly cared for his ailing father by giving him insulin shots and caring for him. So had the jury seen this as a crime motivated by a self-destructive addiction, severe addiction, and intoxication on the night of the crime, they may have been willing, A, to not find that he did not deliberate, and B, that he was not deserving of the ultimate sentence of death. As to the penalty phase, the important statutory mitigator was that Christopher didn't have the capacity to appreciate the criminality of his conduct or conform his conduct to the requirements of the law, and he was substantially impaired. Evidence of voluntary intoxication and alcohol dependence is inherently mitigating. We know that from the U.S. Supreme Court and from this court under Rompilla. But it absolutely requires expert testimony. Counsel couldn't just have put on evidence that there wasn't, you know, drinking going on or that he was drunk. It required expert testimony like Dr. Piasecki to demonstrate that the factors in the statutory mitigator were warranted. In Nice, this court said that evidence of cocaine use and wild behavior and claim delusions simply weren't enough. And in Johnston, while some evidence showed Johnston was a problem drinker, and there was no evidence that showed that he was, through expert testimony, that he was unable to appreciate the wrongfulness of his conduct at the time of the crime. We know that counsel had no strategic reason for not presenting the type of expert testimony through Dr. Piasecki at penalty phase. Counsel was very well aware that Christopher was an alcoholic and addicted to drugs and alcohol. They were well aware that he had risk factors for addiction, including his childhood trauma and parents that abused alcohol. He was genetically predispositioned for it before he ever took a drink. They knew that cognitive impairments were associated with acute and chronic intoxication, and they testified that they knew he had consumed enormous amounts of alcohol on that night, and there are reasons behind that also. He had just lost two of the most important people in his life, his birth mother and his mother, that his adoptive mother that raised him. His wife was divorcing him. There were all sorts of reasons besides his chronic intoxication and addiction that he was drunk that night. But counsel did an investigator consult with any expert related to this theory. In fact, Attorney Moreland, who was responsible for the penalty phase, testified that he did not direct any expert to this theory. So it was not a strategic reason. He didn't consult with an expert on this issue and decide against it.
The state suggests that they did consult with 8 different experts, and they looked at a variety of ways to get into these issues of his mental state, and that they don't have to choose the particular kind of expert you're saying. What they have to do is do a reasonable investigation and consider reasonable amount of expert testimony, and they satisfied that.
But counsel has a duty to investigate the obvious. And the obvious here is that Christopher is an addict and an alcoholic. No expert was directed to investigate that theory. Now, Dr. Orson did a brain scan and didn't find any damage. There was another expert who looked into fetal alcohol syndrome. That has to do with whether his parents were addicted at the time. But no expert looked at what Christopher's unique history was, how it developed, why he was addicted since the age of 14, why he became addicted to drugs and alcohol. He was self-medicating because his parents couldn't afford and didn't refill his prescription medications, and from then he became an addict. Counsel knew all of that, but they didn't do any investigation into an expert who could explain that to a jury and explain why, in light of that, he is not culpable for the crime or not deserving of death, or that his confession couldn't be relied on, because they certainly asked for the videotape of his confession, which would have been the third time he said it in deliberation. So there was nothing they had to counter the very dry recitation of the facts of the crime.
The motion court relied on the testimony of Dr. Draper as fulfilling counsel's responsibility. What's clearly erroneous about that?
Dr. Draper is not an expert in this area whatsoever. And in fact, I don't think she would even fulfill the requirements that this court said were required in Neese and Johnston to put on expert testimony to show how, why this mitigator would be warranted. Because the mitigator specifically requires expert testimony to support it, and she just simply didn't have the qualifications or the expertise to support that mitigator. My time is up. I'll stop later.
May it please the court. Appellant argues this morning that the claims in the amended motion contemplated a claim that counsel failed to investigate and present evidence that intoxication affected his recall and thus called into question his confession. At this moment, I can remember like maybe one or two answers from Dr. Piasecki's testimony that dealt with his memory. And to be honest, I don't recall this being a part of the claim contemplated. It's clear, I think, from the motion court's findings. I think it's clear from appellant's counsel's examinations of the witness, of the various witnesses at the evidentiary hearing, that the claim regarding the research of appellant's intoxication was whether, at least, was related to challenging involuntary intoxication to show that his inhibitions were lowered and to support, if it could be supported, the submission of statutory mitigating circumstance. I simply do not recall any questions being directed to counsel Zembles, who handled the guilt phase, of did you consider offering this evidence of intoxication to show that he could not formulate memories. Now, I could be wrong. I'll admit that. And if appellant counsel can provide that record on reply, that'd be great. But I just simply do not recall counsel being asked those questions. And appellant's counsel in the evidentiary hearing was very explicit at asking for just enough evidence from counsel to kind of check mark their claims and not asking counsel to further explain what they did. Counsel Zembles testified to about intoxication evidence in the guilt phase was about what she was asked. Do you want to offer this kind of evidence in guilt phase? She goes, typically we would not. We find that it sounds like an excuse to the jury, and I found, and she, I think she even said at one point, unfortunately I found through experience, meaning that she had tried this type of defense before in her very long career representing capital defendants, that such a defense is just not a workable guilt phase. She said, hey, no, we'd be willing to use it in penalty phase. But as for guilt phase, she had a significantly sufficient trial strategy reason for not wanting to pursue an intoxication-based defense in the guilt phase. As for this idea that appellant's ability to formulate memories was somehow so shot here that he couldn't have accurately remembered anything, appellant repeatedly spoke to law enforcement about the events of this crime. Especially the first time he talked to, his account of what happened was completely unprompted. When the chief took him out to talk to him, he expected him to implicate David Spears in the crime, not to confess to the things that he confessed. But multiple, and then after that, when police repeatedly attempted to get appellant to say, that's not what happened, wasn't Spears involved too, because he's telling us he was, appellant repeatedly said, that is not what happened. I don't know why he's telling you. I'm telling you what happened. I know what happened. Here's what happened.
Well, is the question what he believed and said, or whether his beliefs that he's relaying in the confessions are true and based on reality, when in fact what he's telling is contrary to the testimony of unrelated people and the physical evidence?
I don't know where appellant says that it's inconsistent with the physical evidence. I find nothing in the record that shows it's inconsistent with physical evidence.
I assume that maybe the dog, cadaver dog, sniffing Mr. Spears' vehicle.
And to be honest, we don't know what that evidence meant or didn't mean. But here's what we do know. The jury didn't think it amounted to such residual doubt as to call appellant's guilt into so much of a question that that it would give him a doubt, benefit of the doubt, and say, hey, maybe something weird happened. Plus, that evidence could have opened up evidence to David Spears' statement about why there might have been cadaver in the Suburban, which was, David Spears says, appellant had me go get the Suburban, brought it back, appellant put the victim's body in the vehicle, appellant drove out to the cave, and appellant deposited the victim's body there.
Which was clearly contrary to what appellant said.
It was contrary to his statement, but it didn't help him. And here's the thing. Counsel understood that, and counsel looked at putting in the details of Spears' statement and said, I didn't want the jury hearing any of that because all of that made my guy sound worse. So it may not have just been that he was wrong, but it could have been, well, I'm going to shade some facts here to make it look like this was a spur-of-the-moment decision, and I really wish I hadn't done it, and I didn't mean it, instead of going, no, whereas Spears' account was, no, appellant was like orchestrating this entire thing and was pretty cold-blooded in doing it. There is no third theory here where David Spears did it by himself or appellant wasn't involved in any way. Otherwise, appellant's statements were fully consistent with the physical evidence, with the timeline as to how long it would take him to get back to Spears' house, to kidnap the victim and bring him back before Mahurin and Spears got back to the house. Appellant couldn't know that Mahurin and Spears weren't going to beat him back to the house or what time they were going to get back to the house, but he did. And that's consistent with testimonies that he said, I think they're going to go back roading, and then, well, they actually did. But he didn't know that. He guessed that. There was evidence at appellant's residence of destroyed and discarded physical evidence from such things as evidence of fiberglass strands in the fire consistent with the type of cord used. There was appellant's knowledge of where the victim was present, appellant's knowledge of how the victim was killed. Appellant's statements were consistent with the physical evidence related to the victim's rape and death. He knew that the victim was raped. That wasn't necessarily something that was knowledge he would have had but for having participated in the crime or but for David Spears telling him, well, I actually did and here's what happened. But appellant, that would have happened days after or sometime after the crime and not when appellant would have been necessarily subject to intoxication, and something appellant repeatedly refused to tell the police, even though in this court commented on direct appeal that several days after, I believe the police just went too far in disregarding his rights, and yet appellant still maintained his story. So his story was extremely detailed. Those details were consistent. He never reported any kind of blackout. He even was able to say that, and then by the next morning, he just laid down and stared at the ceiling. I mean, he remembered everything about that night in specific detail. In light of the multiple times repeated, the extremely detailed nature of it, and the fact that it was actually fully consistent with the other physical evidence and his knowledge of what had happened to the victim, the statement was reliable. And Dr. Piasecki's testimony that, well, alcohol can affect how you remember things, wasn't going to be that overwhelming, especially in light of the fact that as the motion court found, people know that. And I think even appellant kind of said, well, we know what it's like to be around drunk and intoxicated and addicted people. That drunk people will experience blackouts. This isn't necessarily something that would have been so far outside the realm of the jurors that, well, maybe he doesn't accurately remember because he had at least a significant amount to drink. Now, as for the 30 beers deep, I think there actually was contrary evidence at trial that appellant actually by himself did not drink all of the malt liquor beverage that was purchased that night, that those were actually shared among, whether it be at the trial evidence or also from Mr. Spears' statements. I don't remember at this exact moment. But in addition to all of that about the statement, when we just go look at what did counsel do to investigate appellant's mental state and his mental abilities, regardless of what appellant's claiming, this is an expert shopping claim. Appellant points to testimony that counsel said he didn't hire an expert who specifically was self-identified as an expert in addition. And if you look at Mr. Moreland's testimony, that's what he was limited to. Now, I'll guarantee Mr. Moreland did not answer any question beyond what was asked of him at the evidentiary hearing. He was still being as helpful as he could to the claims that were raised. But when they said, because at one point they even asked, because you didn't investigate it? And he goes, oh, I investigated. And here is what he did. He hired a psychologist who had experience with intoxication. And she says, well, she said, appellant argues, well, it's fetal alcohol syndrome, so it's not the same thing, but clearly effects of alcohol on the body. Hired a neuropsychologist who would be familiar with the effects of upbringing and psychological influences, including alcohol on the brain. Hired a forensic psychiatrist, Dr. Logan, who I'm familiar with from various cases for this court, and typically if there's a defense Dr. Logan support, he typically finds it. And here, counsel employed Dr. Logan to look at appellant. Those are, at the very least, three trained professionals who would be familiar with the concepts of alcohol intoxication, alcohol dependence, and alcohol abuse because they're mental health professionals. Again, appellant talks about addiction like this is some like groundbreaking new research and like, well, you know, addiction has drastically changed, but the things that Dr. Piasecki testified to weren't staggering. It causes a loss of inhibition. Again, a fact that an average juror would tend to know, and the motion court found as such. It makes your decision making processes different. It could affect your memory. Those were all things that not only could Dr. Piasecki know, but that Dr. Logan certainly would have known, and the neuropsychologist would have certainly known, and the other psychologist would have known. They hired a neuroradiologist. They did the explicit kind of testing that Dr. Piasecki faulted them for not doing. What Dr. Piasecki said, well, they did it, but they didn't do it good enough. But the doctor, I believe his name was Orson, who conducted it, said, well, it is good enough. I mean, ideally, you'd get a 3D brain scan, but if you can't get that, at least get this. This will be good enough to diagnose these brain deficiencies that we should see if your theory is right. If your theory is that somehow the alcohol abuse somehow affected the brain. In all, counsel hired 8 different experts in either mental health professions or in sex offenses to aid with defense, at least 3 of which who explicitly were psychiatrists or psychologists who clearly would have evidence. Appellant suggesting that a psychiatrist or a psychologist won't think to ask for a DSM diagnosis, which alcohol abuse and alcohol dependence and those things are actual diagnoses that a psychiatrist or psychologist would clearly know about, unless the defense counsel says, oh, you need to check out whether alcohol could have affected his brain too, there's an extent to which that's preposterous. Clearly they would know to look at those things because that's what they're trained to do. Here, and it's true, at trial, defense counsel only called Dr. Draper. Decided to only call the developmental psychologist. And in her testimony, she talked some about alcohol, and admittedly she did not talk that much about it. She talked extensively about sexual abuse claims, the same kind of evidence that he claimed other witnesses were going to present. And she talked about developmental issues, which Dr. Piasecki claims she also would have testified about. But here's the thing, counsel only called Dr. Draper, counsel fully investigated the effects of potential mental diseases and defects, defensive mental disorders, and that includes diagnosable disorders relating to alcohol. Counsel, basically the claim here is, well, counsel hired 8 experts, counsel should have hired a 9th. And this court has repeatedly held, counsel does not have to scour the globe to find this this specific expert in the recent case from within the last year or so of State versus Davis. It's the same type of claim. The defense hired or had a state psych done through a psychiatrist. And they go, well, you should have hired a trauma expert who's a psychologist. And this court said, no, that's just a reasonable choice of difference in choice of expert. Here's the same thing. Even though the state's witnesses weren't, or excuse me, the trial defense witnesses weren't explicitly identified as addiction experts, they were sufficiently qualified to make those diagnoses. And appellant also at the evidentiary hearing never really asked about the depth of what that evidence was. Well, did Dr. Logan know about the alcohol problems? Never bothered to ask any of those questions. Never bothered to ask the identity of the other experts. Appellant tried to limit the evidence at the evidentiary instead of fully proving his claim that what counsel's investigation was done sufficiently. He bore the burden proving that counsel's investigation was insufficient. He failed to prove that claim. Counsel's not ineffective for failing to conduct further investigation into appellant's mental state or to present that evidence to the jury. There are no questions.
Unfortunately, we have a very recent example of false memories sending someone to prison. In this case, it's more serious because it's death. But Ryan Ferguson was convicted and spent a decade in prison on the false memories of his co-defendant, who was heavily intoxicated, blacked out, and unable to remember his actions after leaving a bar, and yet he said that the two of them committed this heinous crime. The same memories were affecting Christopher, but the jury didn't hear anything about it. And the claim that was pled was that the counsel failed to have the jury consider all evidence that rebuts the state's evidence on every element of the offense. Clearly, the state relied almost completely on his confession. And counsel put on no evidence to rebut the inferences that are drawn about his guilt from his confession.
In the Ferguson case, there was not additional evidence that corroborated the confession. The state argues in this case there was much evidence that corroborated the confession. The destroyed belongings at the house, that he knew the location of the body, how she was killed, etc. Isn't that a very different circumstance?
It doesn't show that his memories were based on what he experienced, what he remembered.
Is there any evidence that there was an opportunity to plant false memories?
Absolutely. I mean, talking to David Spears afterwards about what happened, he could have come to believe that this is what happened and that, and he must have done it, or he must have helped, or he's covering for David Spears in some way that neither of them remembered, but all of the events, but that this is what happened. I mean, David himself confessed to strangling her. Christopher said it was him that strangled her. David's mom said that he came and took the Suburban and was gone all night. He prevented Rowan's mother from calling the police. He prevented David Spears stopped her mother from going to even look for her. He tried to set up an alibi for himself. I mean, all of the evidence that the defense tried to put on in penalty to show that David Spears was really the one who committed this crime, and Christopher may have known about it, but may have helped cover it up, but was not the prime mover in this case, all of that evidence would have been presented by the state to get a conviction and death sentence against David Spears. The reason why Christopher is on death row now is because of these confessions that he made that came first. and they're all consistent because he's good at repeating what he said. But they're based on false memories that the jury knew nothing about. They were based on intoxication and high levels of incapacity that the jury knew nothing about and was not fully able to evaluate when they were considering guilt or penalty.
But what about the trial counsel's testimony, the guilt phase, trial counsel's testimony that based on her experience that this is, we got to stay away from alcohol evidence because that's backfired.
I think that's patently frivolous testimony because she's the one who talked about the intoxication and the 30 beers. She mentioned 30 beers that they were drinking in her opening statement. She elicited how much they had to drink from Nathan Mahurin. That was in the defense case. So if that was her explanation after the fact, it's patently not consistent with what the strategy that she used at trial. So I don't think it should carry any weight.
Is there a distinction from drawing the sting on facts and circumstances that are going to come in anyway and bringing in expert testimony to do an in-depth deep dive on addiction and alcohol and its effects on memory?
In a case like this, where his confession was the only evidence, truly the only evidence against him, otherwise the state would have presented a lot of other, they presented evidence that corroborated what his statement was, but that his actual statement was the focus of the state's case. If you don't challenge that and explain why his memories are not accurate, could have been implanted by David Spears, who clearly knew other facts of the crime, then the jury had no reason to give weight to that alcohol testimony, generic alcohol testimony. It just sounded like there were people out drinking that night, not the severity of it and what it would have done to his brain and how it would have affected his memories and the confession. And it violates every notion of fairness and justice to execute a person whose brain was not capable of forming a deliberative intent and was not capable of forming memories that were the basis of his confession. And I'm asking this court to grant a new trial, guilt or penalty phase, where a jury can consider that evidence. Thank you. Thank you.